This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with People's Law Office attorney Flint Taylor out of Chicago, who talks about the lessons of the recent important victory in the conviction for perjury of police torturer John Burge. The number one lesson from this is that the almost all-white jury in Chicago rose to a very high level of humanity, found this guy guilty, and send a message across the country, let's do the same thing to the federal torturers, starting with Cheney and Rumsfeld. We interview two longtime activists in Detroit who participated in the recent United States Social Forum in that city. We'll be talking with National Lawyers Guild leader, attorney Ron Riosti, longtime Detroit activist and attorney, and we'll be talking with John Williams, an historic figure in Detroit's history, who both founded the League for Revolutionary Black Workers as well as the Black Panther Party.
Stay with us.
Former Chicago Police Commander John Burge was found guilty last week, 25 years after the evidence of torture and police abuse was brought forward. Burge was not convicted of abusing prisoners. The statute of limitations on those crimes had passed. He was convicted of perjury and obstruction of justice for lying about the abuse in a civil case. According to the People's Law Offices in Chicago, at least 24 African-American men are still serving sentences for crimes they say they confessed to after being tortured by Chicago police officers. This happened in a Chicago police precinct under the command of John Burge in the early 70s all the way up to 1992. Burge is a former Vietnam vet who brought back torture techniques from that American war. Flint Taylor says Burge shot through the ranks all the way to commander, primarily by leading a band of torturers. They used methods like electric shock, suffocating people with bags, and bashing them over the head with telephone books. The People's Law Office brought a tort case in 2005, but the city of Chicago refused to settle. Taylor says the city spent over $10 million in aiding the defense of Commander Burge. Burge is now 62 years old, in ill health, and was fired from the Chicago Police Department in 1993. After his conviction, he faces up to 45 years in prison. Attorney Flint Taylor joins us today to talk more about the case. Flint's a graduate of Brown University and Northwestern University Law School and a founding partner of the People's Law Office. Flint Taylor, welcome to Law and Disorder.
I'm happy to be with you again, Mike.
Well, this is the fourth time. The other three times we're talking about your pursuit of John Burge, and this time it's to congratulate you because, as I'm sure our audience has already heard, John Burge was found guilty of perjury, and he's looking at 45 years in prison. Flint, give us, in a nutshell, what happened on the perjury charge, because we want to really talk about the lessons of this all. And I think that won't be yesterday's news because the lessons are what's so important for all of us to absorb. But tell us in a nutshell how Burge was finally cornered and convicted.
Well, as you know, the torture allegations started to arise almost 40 years ago. As early as 1982, the mayor of the city of Chicago, who was then the prosecutor, the state's attorney elected, Richard Daley, was presented with evidence that would have put Burge away for torture if he had pursued it. And, of course, Daley didn't pursue it. Superintendents of police didn't pursue it. It was only 10 years later in the 90s, early 90s, that because of the movement that arose around all of this torture and the human rights violations, that Burge was finally fired. But he was never prosecuted, and Justice Department after Justice Department rejected our pleas to look into it as a criminal matter. And as time went on, there was no longer the ability to go after him for torture or civil rights violations or aggravated battery or attempted murder or any of those substantive charges because the statutes had all run out on that. So as the movement continued to grow and it also joined with the movement against the death penalty here and had some real success in getting some men who were tortured off of death row and actually pardoned on the basis of innocence when Governor Ryan was still here in the early 2000s. There was a movement for a special prosecutor because the hands of Daley and his first assistant, Richard Devine, which were so dirty as well, Devine went on to be the state's attorney here, so there was a major conflict of interest. He wouldn't prosecute for anything. They appointed a special prosecutor in the early 2000s, but that special prosecutor turned out to be very close to Daley, and he wouldn't indict for any offenses either. At that point, we had devised a theory, which was, if you can't prosecute him for torture, at least prosecute him for obstruction of justice, lying, perjury, because they consistently would come into court in our civil cases and lie about having tortured people. He said, well, get them for that. Al Capone, you know, the same kind of thing. If you can't get them for the torture, get them for the lying and the obstruction. And finally, in 2008, after the special prosecutor issued a whitewash report, the movement again was outraged, and we had hearings in front of city council, hearings in front of the county board, and the U.S. attorney here, Patrick Fitzgerald, a Republican, who's well known for pursuing not only terrorists back when he was in New York, he was at the New York, either a first assistant or U.S. attorney there. He's also went after Scooter Libby, and so he went after Burge, and he went after Burge and for obstruction of justice and perjury, as we all urged him to do so, and indicted him, and rolled over one cop. He broke the code of silence with regard to one white cop and got him to come forward and to talk about one incident of torture. So they prosecuted him. Nobody thought that they could get him. Burge exercised all his peremptory challenges in court on the jury to get rid of all the black jurors. Fortunately, the judge was a very liberal and fair-minded judge, Judge Joan Lefko, and she granted the government's reverse Batson challenge to two of the...
Beautiful.
And so she brought back the one black person on the jury that was there and one of the two alternates. So there was one black person on the jury. So I think all of us were fearful. And then Burge's defense was basically five men testified, said they were tortured. There was corroboration, medical lawyers and others came forward, family members, to corroborate the fact that they were tortured. But the attack by Burge was they're all, it was totally racist. They're gangbangers, they're criminals, they're lowlifes, they're monsters, as his lawyer called them in the closing argument. And it was an unbridled racist defense, and it wasn't even subtle, really. And that these five men were all not to be believed because they were black and criminals and poor and all that. And the pitch was obviously to a predominantly white jury, but the jury rejected it and found him guilty on all three charges, one charge of perjury and two charges of obstruction of justice. As you pointed out, he could get 45 years, but that's just, you know, adding all the charges together. And the federal guidelines would probably put him in the 9 to 10 year category. His lawyers argued one of the main witnesses against Burge was a convicted police killer, and he had since died. But he was courageous in that he came forward again and again to testify about how he'd been tortured after he was arrested for killing these two cops. Burge's argument was that somewhere in the darkest, dingiest corner of hell, Andrew Wilson, that's the man we're talking about, is laughing because he pulled this over on someone. And my statement is that, you know, someone else can decide who's in the darkest and dingiest corner of hell if there is one. But what we all fought for and we hope happens is that Burge will be in the darkest and dingiest corner of some federal penitentiary.
Well, Flint, you know, the great tradition in this country going all the way back to the IWW, when you fought in the courthouse and you also fought in the streets. And this is what was done here with the People's Law Office in Chicago and the kind of support you got in the community. Talk to us about that.
Well, it was a long, hard struggle, and it hasn't ended, obviously. We can talk about that a little later on. But people were outraged when they heard about that there was torture going on, particularly in the African-American community. And over time, as we were able to uncover more and more evidence of that this wasn't just one case of torture, but it was many, many cases of torture, and it was all masterminded by the same commander, and it was totally racially based and all of that. And movements came together, and the two major movements that came together was the movement against police brutality and for human rights, and the movement against the death penalty. And when those movements converged in the first in the early 1990s, it helped to get Burge fired, and then again and more directly in the early 2000s, it led to the death row, the pardons and commutations. And so as all of that went on, more and more education was going on about torture and about how at least some of the men who were tortured were innocent, had given false confessions. And our position always was and continues to be, torture is wrong. It doesn't matter if you're guilty or innocent of the crime. It doesn't matter what crime you're charged with. Torture is torture. It's a crime against humanity, and it should be treated as such. And as that got more and more traction, we got traction not only here, but also internationally. And people from the movement went to not only to the Organization of American States and their Human Rights Commission and had a hearing there, but we also went to the UN's Committee Against Torture. And we were able to get a resolution from the Committee Against Torture, which linked Chicago to Guantanamo and Guantanamo to Bagram and all of that. And it called for prosecutions. It called on the U.S. government to prosecute here. So all of that created a critical mass. We also joined with the movement against the Olympics here. And so the Olympics, which was Daley's big deal, was something that not only did the community not want for the obvious reasons, economic and other reasons, and lessons from other cities in this country, but because this city had not effectively and totally dealt with the stain of torture which was on its conscience. And so there were many movements that we joined up with, and ultimately it led to where we are today. And now we're looking to the next things that we need to accomplish, because this is a significant win in a battle, in a struggle that's gone on and will continue to go on until there's complete justice, or I guess there cannot be complete justice, but there is as much justice as can be had in the circumstances.
Well, exactly. There are still, 23 people still in prison, reparations to be paid for those who were victimized by this. That's the ongoing struggle in Chicago.
That, and throw in one other things that are important as well, and that is we are fighting very hard to have those who worked with Burge indicted as well under the same theories of obstruction of justice and perjury, and also that there is a federal statute that's being proposed by Danny Davis that police torture be a federal crime without a statute of limitations, so that the next Burges, whether it's in Chicago or somewhere else, New York or New Orleans or wherever, if they're able to cover up or use the structure to cover up for 5, 10, 15 years their systematic brutality or torture, they can still be prosecuted for the underlying torture, not just for obstruction of justice.
Yeah, well, that brings me to my next question, because obviously in Chicago, you guys didn't follow Obama's advice of looking forward, not backward. And the statute is rapidly running with on Rumsfeld and Cheney and Ashcroft, even Bush, all those attorneys and others in the Bush administration that were responsible for torture in our name here in our country. How do you link up the two struggles in Chicago and the national question?
Well, it's too bad that Barack Obama didn't listen a little more closely when he was here in Chicago concerning the struggle that was going on about torture. And in fact, some of his law partners here in Chicago have been allies of us in this struggle, in issuing shadow reports and all other kinds of things we've done along the way. But apparently he didn't get the memo, as they say. And the link is clear in many ways. First of all, this is torture. We're talking about the kinds of techniques. We see the same techniques that were used in Vietnam, Burge and his men used here. The same techniques that were used and are used at the secret sites in Guantanamo and Bagram and places like that, Abu Ghraib, were used here. The kind of torture is the same, number one. So the violations of human rights and the violations of international law are the same. And number two, well, it took 30 years to get this man in the dock, but he's in the dock, and he's convicted. And he's convicted by a Republican U.S. attorney. Now, what does that say about the torture that went on under the name of Bush and Cheney? And with their admissions, by the way, Cheney has obviously admitted that he was a torturer and that he knew about the torture. Here, the city can't go forward. Its conscience can't be cleansed until there's complete dealings by all of the different governments with the torture. We know that to be the case in other countries around the world as well, whether it be Chile, South Africa. However you deal with those problems, you have to deal with them. If you don't, that stain is on the conscience of the entire society, but particularly on the government. And that's what Obama's administration is ignoring. And the people who are fighting out there to get Cheney and all of those folks under him indicted, Rove and those people, they can take some solace and some strength from how long it took us, but that we did succeed. And conversely, the Obama administration has to take some heed of the fact that people united, as they say, will not be defeated, and that however long it takes, you can't give up this fight. You can't just say, oh, well, that's in the past. And those countries and those municipalities who do that never, in fact, can really look themselves in the mirror and deal with the conscience, the human rights conscience of that society. And if that society wants to have any semblance of a human rights conscience, it has to deal with its human rights violations.
Yeah, exactly, Flint. We're speaking with Flint Taylor from the People's Law Office on his and the community's marvelous victory over the forces of evil in Chicago with the conviction of perjury of John Burge, who's now looking at a prison sentence. One, I think, lamentable fact is that there weren't enough people in the United States generally outraged at the torture that was done in their name. And I think that reason for that was the fear that was instilled in people. And they were told, you know, we got to get this information. We had to use these extraordinary means, and we did it to protect you. And I think they scared people enough so that you didn't have the kind of groundswell nationally to call for bringing Cheney and the rest of them to justice as you were able to accomplish in Chicago.
Well, that's right, but it's interesting to see the jury, that the interviews with the jury here, because obviously we who had been involved and continue to be involved in the anti-torture movement understand that you know, the polls and the fact that many people say that you can torture, quote, terrorists, you can torture certain people. And of course, we know that's a slippery slope and that's wrong and all of that, but we were concerned that with only one black person on this jury, that they were going to buy the same idea, which was you can torture black criminal gangbangers, you know, that kind of thing. And the defense made an extremely strong statement in that regard, because all of the five men who testified were at one point or another in leaders in gangs, except for one, had long criminal records that were all came in, whether it was killing two cops or strings of robberies or, you know, murder or whatever. So they then were saying, in not too polite terms, try to torture these people. They're poor, they're black, they're criminals, they're, as they said in their closing argument, they're monsters of the South Side. They were monsters. And so, but this jury of almost all white people said no. And in fact, some of them were quoted as saying, look, they're human beings like we are. They shouldn't be tortured. That's the message. You know, it's a very, you know, common sense message from the jury, which was, it doesn't matter. You know, it doesn't matter who they are. It's a human rights violation, and that's what we have to keep. That has to be what our message is. And I've seen people who get fearful when they raise the issue of who the victim is. I mean, it's just really important to stay strong about the fact that torture is wrong, period.
Yeah, it's really inspiring to see that people overcame whatever inherent racism there may be out there, because I think racism is a big part of the torture issue, and it was overcome, and you triumphed. And we're all so proud of you, Flint, really. Thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder, and thanks for your good work. And we're looking forward to the book that's going to come out of this. It's going to be the sequel to Jeff Haas's book.
Well, yes, maybe that'll happen. And hopefully we'll be able to get some of these other torturers indicted out here, and hopefully that the kind of veil will come off of this, nationally, that the Rachel Maddows and the Keith Olbermans and Ed Schultzes of the world, progressive world, will kind of take note of this. So far, there's been kind of, without the exception of Amy Goodman and yourself and some of the other progressive outlets, kind of ignoring what should be a major, major victory declared in the progressive community across this country.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Flint Taylor, keep up the good work.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks for being on Law and Disorder.
Right.
You take it easy.
Yeah, I will.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
We get another perspective on the U.S. Social Forum from Ron Riosti, one of the leaders of the National Lawyers Guild in Detroit and a longtime social activist. Riosti ran for attorney general in the 60s. He was active in the anti-war movement both during the period of Vietnam and then Central America. He brought a famous lawsuit against General Motors to prevent them from wiping out part of a historic Polish section of Detroit. And he recently was victorious, along with several other lawyers, in a lawsuit against the state of Michigan for the rape and abuse of hundreds of black female prisoners. Attorney Ron Riosti, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Ron, I caught up with you in Detroit the week before last at the U.S. Social Forum, and you and a number of other people were on a panel at Wayne State University called Radical Dreaming, Detroit in the 60s and the 70s. And I wanted to ask you if you could recapitulate for our audience here on the radio show what you had to say about Detroit and radical dreaming in the 60s and 70s when you were active then.
Well, one of the focuses was on the fact that I was around in the 50s as well as in the 60s. I think I pointed out that Detroit had a radical history even before the 50s based on the labor movement and also based on a really vibrant black community. But that obviously, as the 50s rolled around, it was the period of the Korean War and McCarthyism and anti-communism and the beginning of the Cold War. And although maybe Detroit didn't get hit as hard as some other communities in terms of the McCarthyism, it certainly had an effect. But I pointed out that the two things that really changed things around and led, I think, to the radicalization of the 60s was first the defeat of McCarthyism in the mid-50s, and then the struggle for civil rights in the South, which was obviously very inspiring. And, of course, there was also the revolt of the colonies, struggle for liberation in the Third World or in the undeveloped world. And all of these things came together and, of course, did produce radicalization in the 60s, which was, I think, unique in a number of ways. One was the depth of the radicalization, the fact that it included non-working class youth, that there was a real cultural component to this radicalization. I also pointed out that it lasted until the 60s and 70s. I mean, obviously, one point people would mention is the fact that the 60s was primarily a revolt of middle-class youth against the war in Vietnam because of the draft, but obviously the radicalization continued for a significant period of time after the draft was ended. And radicalization lasted until into the 80s. There was a big demonstration against the war in Central America in Detroit in the 80s. Thousands of people packed downtown. There was obviously a hope for more radical changes. But we continued during this period of time to, in Detroit, experience the deindustrialization of the city, which had been begun back in the 50s. We didn't really notice it so much then. But it became more obvious as the time went on. It became obvious in the 70s that this was going on. What was considered to be white flight as a result of the rebellion, the race rebellion, the rebellion of the black community in 1967 was really just perhaps an acceleration of a process that had begun in the 50s with the suburbanization and the deindustrialization of Detroit. And it wasn't just simply a matter of building suburbs during the 50s. There were a significant number of auto plants in the city itself that were closed in the 50s, in the 60s, in the 70s, and even into the 80s. I mean, obviously, as the population of the city was decreasing, as the economic base of the city was eroding, it had an effect on the radicalization. And, of course, the other thing that was happening throughout that whole period of time was the radicalization kept getting channeled into the Democratic Party, which, of course, was just one disappointment after another.
And continues to be.
Fortunately, the radical community didn't seem to learn the lessons.
That you're coming upon one of my next questions. But before I get there, what are your impressions of this magnificent, huge gathering, mostly young people, very diverse racially from all over the country, and bringing with them all different kinds of movement concerns? It was really quite a phenomenon, wasn't it?
It was very encouraging. It was very impressive. The march on Wednesday was really impressive and encouraging, very spirited. There were a lot of new ideas. People are grappling with solutions to the capitalist system, trying to figure out how you could run a post-capitalist society without sacrificing democratic values, trying to figure out how to run, in essence, a socialist economy without central planning. There's obviously an effort to try to figure out a political model that is something other than models of the early 20th century, which, of course, is another discussion altogether. I mean, there's not only a repudiation of Stalinism, which I consider to be very healthy, but also a repudiation of Leninism, which I think is maybe more of a knee-jerk reaction to the demonization of the Bolsheviks that has occurred over the last 30 years.
And I also think a kind of a mischaracterization of what was Leninism and characterizing it as some kind of bullet-hard, extremely centralized party when it doesn't necessarily have to be that.
You know, I think some of these younger people, and of course all of them are younger than you and I, aren't that misinformed about Leninism. I think some of the debates around Leninism are healthy, but I think it's also true that a lot of it is just imbibing the demonization. And maybe there isn't as thorough an analysis of political problems of overthrowing capitalism than there should be. But on the other hand, I think some of it really is pretty healthy.
Yeah, it was kind of hard to get a handle on it because there were so many people and there was so many activities and workshops and plenaries all going on almost at the same time. But my general impression was that the level of anti-capitalist consciousness amongst the people that were there at the U.S. Social Forum in Detroit 2 weeks ago was much different than the kind of level of anti-capitalist consciousness that we experienced in the 50s and the 60s.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think there's more of a grappling with some of these issues. The issues that I mentioned. One, what kind of a society do you build after you overthrow capitalism, or if you can overthrow capitalism? And secondly, I think there's a re-examination of the idea of how to overthrow capitalism. And I think in the 60s, it was the choices were either, SDS model, which perhaps we'd call naive. The other model was the Stalinist versus Trotskyist.
Yeah. You had a lot of discussions with people. I saw you speaking with, I suppose they would call themselves an anarchist group of intellectuals on how you organize a democratic economy. I mean, what kind of ideas do you think that people are talking about now that were manifest at the social forum?
Not only at the social forum, but also from my own kids, I get the impression that there really is an effort to try to put together a model of how you would run an economy democratically without the capitalists. Some of those ideas involve a market. Some of them involve various degrees of central planning. Some of them really elaborate methods of having a democratic system in place of central planning. But I think that, they're doing a good job in trying to come up with the answers. I think the other part of that, the problem, of course, is coming up with a political answer as well.
Yeah,
I think people are grappling with that. But, I think they're grappling with it in the sense of trying to find other people who are like-minded.
I was thinking that's had to be kind of the general direction or thrust to come out of a meeting like the U.S. Social Forum. What do we do next, and who do we do it with, and under what program? That it seemed to me that the Social Forum was kind of an initiation as a kind of a process questions are still kind of open to see how they evolved. Did you get that feeling?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it's very healthy. I think they're learning the lessons of the 60s. There really isn't the sectarianism that we experienced during the 60s. I think there also isn't the naivete or the exaggerated notion of importance of the youth. I think they've been humbled by the experience of the last 30 years.
I think also there are, in addition to the problem of continuing war, added on to that is the threat of an economic collapse, and superimposed on all of it is a collapse of the whole ecological system. So there's kind of a urgency to things now that are even greater than the urgency to stop a slaughter in Vietnam.
The young people there seem to be smarter than we were. They seem to maybe know a little bit more about the history than our peers did. And I think to some extent they benefited from the cultural changes that have occurred in this country over the last 50 years. I mean, when we were young people, when I was a young person in the 50s, it was a society where there was total control by the pro-capitalist forces. I mean, it was not only just total control over the intellectual and political environment, but it was also a total cultural control. The cultural control in terms of sexism, in terms of patriarchal nature of the society, in terms of everything, in terms of dress, in terms of lifestyles, in terms of alternative ways of living and making a living, all those things have changed. They've changed dramatically. And I think these kids really are able to imagine a society which is not based on capitalist.
Ron Riosti, you've been a leading left-wing attorney in Detroit for almost 50 years. You've participated in various struggles representing employment cases, brutality in prison cases, labor unions. What would you say now to a young lawyer coming up about what kind of activities would you encourage people to get involved in now?
I don't know about lawyers. I think lawyers should make themselves available to the movements that arise. You know, I think the movements that arise are all good. Obviously, we never talked about the environment. I think the environment has got to be a major focus for everybody, whether we like it or not. I don't think it's a matter of choice. I think the other things to focus on are building a anti-capitalist, pro-socialist movement, which means basically learning the history of these struggles, thinking seriously about alternatives, thinking real hard about the biggest problems that we have not been able to solve, which is to really build a left movement that is significant in this country. And of course, that involves dealing with the whole issue of the Democratic Party. I mean, if you want an anti-capitalist economy, an anti-capitalist society, then you got to give up capitalist parties. And that's what the Democratic Party is a capitalist party.
With that insight, I want to thank you and tell you we truly appreciated your being on Law and Disorder. Yeah. Ron Riosti from Detroit, we much appreciate it. We'll get back to you again hopefully very soon. You take it easy.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Today, we talk with John Williams, one of the featured speakers at the recent U.S. Social Forum and a longtime leader of Detroit's black community. John Williams was a central organizer of the historic League of Revolutionary Black Workers in Detroit. He worked at both the Ford and the Chrysler plant and taught at Wayne State University. John was also a founding member of the Detroit chapter of the Black Panther Party and a founding member of the Detroit Labor Party. John Williams, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Hi, how are you? Glad to be here.
I'm glad to see you, you know. I didn't know you. I knew of you. I knew a number of your comrades back in Detroit in the 60s. John Watson let me write a column for the Wayne State University College newspaper there. The Inner City Voice. And I, with the masthead that said, one class-conscious worker is worth 1,000 students.
That's
which
right.
is quite a you know, comment on the social weight and importance of workers. And I knew Mike Hamlin. I knew Luke Tripp and John Watson. I was so pleased to make your acquaintance at that workshop, Radical Dreaming, Detroit in the 60s and the 70s.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you if you could just kind of recapitulate for our audience here on Law and Disorder some of the points you were trying to make at that workshop where we met.
The main point I was trying to make at the workshop in the Radical 60s and 60s is that the points that we did then, the things that we used then, the strategy and tactics of the 50s and 60s don't relate now. And I was just going over, looking at the development of, at that point, the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, DRUM, the Panthers, they grew at a time when the capitalist system was kind of expanding. And I was just making some, which I didn't make in the workshop, but I, in retrospect, looking at the things that had guided myself and Luke, as you mentioned, Luke Tripp and some of the others, when the civil rights movement took shape and form, there was this split between King and Malcolm, a perceived split. And we saw it as bigger between King and Robert Williams, who Robert Williams was a guy that was sent out of the country, had a book written, Negroes with Guns, but he used to put out The Crusader. We were more or less in his ilk, that is Robert Williams, who was now deceased. And for the workshop, since we were talking about primarily some of the people who brought up the Panthers, and I wanted to try to say at that point that the League of Revolutionaries for Black Workers at that time saw the worker struggle as predominant and that we moved the Panther chapter into the League. That caused some friction, and we had some contradictions and conflict with the leadership. They were into a more community-oriented but dispossessed from the standpoint of trying to get what we call lumping elements, which also allowed the FBI to get in, and although later on got some people killed here and also got some people killed up in Connecticut. But it was the parting between the League and the Panther Party at the time. When we brought the Panthers in, the head of the Panther chapter was a Ford worker who had built FRUM, which was the Ford Revolutionary Union Movement following after DRUM, and then also into the League. And in addition to breakfast programs, I was talking about how the Panthers was brought into the League. And when we parted ways with the Panthers, they really, I guess, this testosterone was gone on some of the youngsters. And one young man I remember very vividly, he got killed as a result with the police. And then one of the guys on the program, as you saw him there, he also spent quite a bit of time in penitentiary. So, but I was just trying to say that at the time period that we were dealing with, those tactics and strategies don't operate now at this point. We need more of a class perspective at this time, and the opportunity has been given to us at this period because of the tools, which is now with a contracting capitalism. They don't have the need for the concession. And you see the capitalist class in particular, they're doing three basic things. Privatization, which means that anything public, they're taking it over, and that means downsizing. Deregulation, anything that they want. Now they abort the laws and just go right in and take them, like even in Detroit. The Detroit your school board now is just a figment of someone's imagination. They bring in whoever they want to. Same thing with some cities who have been taken over. And then the other thing is the question of taxes. People are fighting now for keeping centers open, hospitals open, schools, but the corporations are getting tremendous tax breaks to do nothing with the idea that profits will bring jobs. Well, we know that that's not the case in the city of Detroit or the nation. Detroit is one of the highest unemployment rates, and so does the state, in spite of the General Motors and them being unrebounding. So
My main emphasis in that was to try to say that even the struggle that went on between the League and the Panthers, but those strategies and tactics at this point won't operate now.
We both disagree with Henry Ford. History is not bunk, but there are certain aspects of history that are valuable. The usable past is what we're talking about.
Yeah.
And we can take from the past what we need and apply it to the future. Thinking about that and looking at Detroit the way it is now compared to the way it was when you and I were both working there in the 60s. Of course, I left, but you've been there forever. And Detroit's a much different place, and the country's a much different place. Where do you see the Black struggle at now, and what kind of impressions did you get from the social forum on where we're at?
Okay, two things. One, let me just say this. In terms of the social forum, I'll tell you what impressed me as opposed to Atlanta. I was in Atlanta also for the first one in 2007. What I didn't see there as much as I've seen, as that I saw at this last one, was two things. One, there was a significant questioning of capitalism on the one hand or outright anti-capitalism on the other. I didn't detect that in Atlanta. And the second one was the many people, especially a number of the youngsters, but even people in our age range and just under us, the moral question. And when I say the moral question, people just took the moral question like, what this country is doing is just wrong. And it's whether it was related to the workers being laid off, thrown into the streets, the immigration question, Gaza, Palestine, environmental questions, whether they were politically impacted by that. It was a moral question. He thought that this was not right, the way things were going. And this drew, some of the people I had a chance to talk to, they were drawn by that. And I thought that was real significant. Now, in Atlanta, I saw smatterings of some of that. But here, it seems that the workshops that I was in and even workshops that I talked to other people who had been in them, this seemed to be a dominant theme, which I thought was quite significant. And even some people talked about the reference to Michael Moore's movie on capitalism, and it's also being questioned quite frequently, as a matter of fact. The other thing in terms of the Black struggle, part of Lerner's position essentially is that...
Let me just stop you for a second, John, and explain what Lerner is for our listeners who are probably not familiar with this new development, a very promising new development. What is Lerner?
The acronym stands, it's the acronym for League of Revolutionaries for New America. And what the Lerner program, what we're about to, at this point, is attempting to develop an organization of revolutionaries, which essentially means individuals who are in and around the country, whatever their perspective is, coming together basically to provide the thing that we think is missing from the element of the workforce that's rising and developing, and that's class consciousness. And looking at history, that's something that doesn't grow with the struggle. And what I mean by that is when you got two elements, two opposing forces who are locked together in order to resolve a system or resolve a struggle, then the two, unless there's something that breaks them apart, they negotiate. And that's what happens. The workforce in this country and the capitalist class have been negotiating, however brutal it may have been, but it was never at any point to get rid of the private property or the means of capitalism until now. And that happened, as far as Lerner sees, it happened as a result of a change in the tools. And the change in the tools, what we call the electronic change, when these things change, that meant that the body of government or the structure is now anachronistic, or it is incohesive for the tools. And therefore, it upset the apple cart for both the capitalist class and the worker. And what we see now, one of the reasons why we say the old things will not work at this point. So consequently, what happens is the two poles objectively are being split apart, but they're being tied together consciously or subjectively by a middle. And we see the middle at this point as being the Democratic Party. And what I mean by the middle is that the fight to reform a system that is contracting at this point is impossible. But the understanding that people have and the history that they come through is that things will change if we continue this fight. Now, should we continue the fight? Yes. But there must be an element essentially, you bring to them, look, this element of class, you know, where one class stands away from the other to see that this other class, being the ruler, is their enemy. And one of the things that Lerner sees is that we're not talking about workers who are tied to capital and continuing to negotiate. We're talking about those, especially in the Rust Belt, who have been thrown out of the process of production. The good organized workers, good union people, but many of them, they either are thrown out, they're either permanently unemployed, temps, contingencies, and these are the force because they're no longer locked into that contradiction with capital. They're no longer as part of that dialectic. They're outside of that, and their means now is to fight straight up against capital. But they cannot fight capital with the old trade union means or the old organizing means. But the introduction of class consciousness has to be brought in. It is not something that essentially it comes up in a particular struggle, because all struggles basically are reform. That's part of the suggestion that Lerner's saying to the movement, that we need to have that element of people to bring this level of consciousness, which means explaining the understanding. And if I may, I used in one workshop in the Civil War, prior to Emancipation Proclamation, and Lincoln and them in the North was in a very difficult thing, and they needed the Northern worker, Northern white worker in particular, to stop slavery and win the war. Well, the Northern white worker at that time was afraid of the slave because he thought the slave would take the job, and they were brutal. There were many attacks on blacks, but within 2 years, with the abolitionists, some of the leaders like Charles Sumner, of course, Frederick Douglass and all, the Negro people in particular fighting, and they brought to the Northern white worker in particular an understanding of the difference in the two bases, the Southern base, which was expanding and would usurp the Northern worker. Anyway, with that understanding brought in, the Northern white worker went fighting with the Union under the banner, if he, meaning Jesus Christ, should die to make men holy, then we shall die to set men free, which was a significant transformation in that conscious understanding of what needed to be done. And, of course, the rest was history.
Exactly. We're talking in the wake of the very impressive U.S. Social Forum. You were an active participant in it. Can you tell me if Lerner had a presence there, and who is it that's joining in to form this new group, Lerner?
Okay. Lerner makes up, in terms of individually, it ranges from senior citizens to youth. Group-wise, it means there are people who are involved in worker struggles, people who are retired, come out of basically out of the factories, but there are professionals who are involved in with Lerner, people within students, within the community, but they're all bound together by a line, an understanding of where America is at this point, where the world is at this point, beginning to understand this question of globalization, which has been pushed by the electronic development. And all we say that is that when the tools change, it upsets the governmental structure. And at that point, it gives us the first time in history to have the opportunity to present another world, like the forum said, another world is possible, another system is possible. That was not relevant several years ago, but it is now. So Lerner attempts to try to meet with people, I don't like to use terms left and right, but people who are progressives who want change, whether they see it's the capitalist system or not, but who are involved in struggles out here. And our attempt is to try to bring together this grouping so we can come together, forming a body to assist the workforce, which has not moved. This independent grouping that we're talking about, it's like a storm that's developing. And the Rust Belt is not the sole one, but it is the most organized worker. It is the most organized of the workers that hope to pull this chain forward. And what we tend to see is that education is one of the keys. We do educationals. We use our paper, which is called the Rally Comrade. There are books and stuff that has been written. And in the social forum, what we attempted to try to do is to get in the forums, especially where we were, or significant forums that were important, for instance, the question of immigration, although we had people there, to try to talk about this question of class. And it's not just a question of black versus white, and the question of consciousness. Where is the level of consciousness of the workers who are dispossessed? And what we try to make clear is we're not talking about workers who are still tied to the capitalists, who are trying to develop reforms, although it's at a defeated situation, but those workers who are being thrown out, by the tools, they formed a body, the embodiment of the fight. So this is the thing we've been suggesting and trying to share with individuals. And I just one other point. When I was in a workshop called Post-Capitalism or Non-Capitalist Detroit, and many people who take that position is that they're trying to develop things that's ancillary to capitalism. Capitalism is a problem right now, so what we're going to do is build co-ops. We're going to build gardens, which we share with that's important. The problem is if you take that as a goal, that's your way of saying that capitalism is there, we can't defeat it, so we're going to build these other alternatives, and that's part of the problem. Our point is that while you build these things, you use them to educate people that this can be greater, but if you try to do this and allow capitalism to stand, it's not going to work.
Yeah, I totally understand what you're saying. And as I was touring through Detroit, you can see where these ideas are coming from, because whole neighborhoods have been leveled, cleared, and there's waving fields of weeds right in the center of Detroit.
Yeah.
People are coming in and saying, we want to put dairy farms in Detroit. It's really quite remarkable, considering that Detroit was one of the largest cities in America in the 50s, and it's lost almost two-thirds of its population now. It was really one of the first cities to be deindustrialized. But, John, what impressed me about the social forum and what also kind of disturbed me at the same time, it was so huge. There were 15,000 or more people, mostly young people, not people our age. They had many, many different kinds of concerns. There was a great spirit of camaraderie there. At any one moment, there'd be 100 workshops going on. I'm not exaggerating.
So
it was kind of hard to get a handle on it, you know? You didn't know where to go. There wasn't any kind of cohesion. There wasn't any kind of plenary session where a vote was taken or even an agreement on when the next meeting was going to happen. It was just, you know, all these activists and militants along all the fronts coming together, which was great, but it also seemed kind of incohesive at the same time. You understand what I'm trying to say?
Yes. As a matter of fact, in part of the principles they talk about, the forum in and of itself is principally sort of an event where you progress, as they call it, come to network. You get what you get out of it, and then you go on back to whatever you want to do, but it's not a body whereby the forum comes out with a solid position on this or a solid position on that. It's more like a network. And I remember this was prior to the 2007 social forum, but I can't think of her name now, but she's from India. I know she made the first one in Brazil, but I read an article by her, and she said, I'm tired of going to the forums, and they don't take a national stand, like we're going to do something together as a body, as a group. This was part of the thing that was going on. But I was just reading the other day in the workbook, and when they talk about part of the principles, they said it's more like networking, where you come together, and then you take what you get back to wherever it is you're going to go and go and fight for whatever you want to. You can meet new people, but we provide the basis for it, which is good.
So, John, what do you think we should do? There was that marvelous success of the social forum in terms of turning out thousands and thousands and thousands of social movement activists. But what should they do next? You're active in the group Lerna. What are you telling people to do next? What's the message that we want to leave our listenership with?
Well, the thing that we're doing at this point is to try to bring to people that since the corporations were bailed out and the banks, our thing is we call for nationalization of corporations, energy, the single-pay health care, because those fights put us straight up against capital. And it brings people into not just a particular fight against your school or your particular job. It brings you straight up against capital, demanding that these things that take care of the people as opposed to the Wall Street and the corporations. That's one of our major tactics. And in that, you can do educations around those struggles. And they seem to be taking on to some extent.
We're going to put up Lerna's website and phone number up on lawanddisorder.org, our website.
Okay.
And I wanted to ask if you have any last words for our audience.
Well, the only thing I would say is at this point in time, we don't know when this struggle is going to break, but believe me, you can see the rising tide in America, and we may see something similar to Greece and Iceland. And all I'm saying is that essentially what all Lerna wants to do is to try to blend with the activists and people who at a certain level, when I say activists, I'm talking about people from the community, workers and all, to try at this point to get an understanding of how significant this class question is and don't get bought off by making that the immigration is a problem or that it's black or that it's white. Stay the course and understand that this system and the class of Wall Street and corporations is our problem.
Well, John Williams, great to talk to you. I was on the same page with you 40 years ago, and I'm still on the same page. And you keep up your good work. Thanks for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.